Good evening, everybody. My name is Chris. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Chris.
Anybody remember where we ended up last week? I have a vague recollection. Is it hazy recollection?
Now and then.
Now and then is where we're starting?
Yep. That's it.
That's what
we're
doing.
Wow, I was actually correct for once. It's like a broken clock. You're up, Chris.
56 in this book in the gray section. And in the blue book, it's page 123, paragraph 4.
All right. So for anybody that's new, I see some people that might not have been at this meeting before. What Dave and I are doing, and this is the last night until the next time we start this back up, who knows when that'll be. We're going over the original manuscript. Now, a little bit about the original manuscript. When Bill in the first 100 put the book Alcoholics Anonymous together, there were drafts, okay? And what the original manuscript was they printed up these copies of the original manuscript so that they could pass them out to people to do some editing or make some suggestions, and different people got these manuscripts and different people had comments on what needed to be changed, and they incorporated some of that stuff into what they put together into the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And why we like going back and looking at the original manuscript every once in a while is basically because that's where the alcoholics left it. When they sent out the original manuscript, they sent it out to religious people, editors, medical people, and most of the suggestions were made by them. So I just find it interesting to go back and see where Bill and the first 100 or so left this information. And you can see that in the original manuscript. Now, we've been covering a bunch of stuff. This is the third iteration of Dave and I going through the original manuscript, and we have done it very, very slowly, and we've covered the material probably more than we needed to. We're only on page 56, and we started this 8 years ago, right?
Yeah.
And some nights we get through like four paragraphs or whatever, and then when people have had enough of us, they kick us off the table and they put somebody else up here, and that'll happen next week. But we've been covering a lot of stuff. We looked at what alcoholism was. We looked at the program of recovery, what you need to do to recover from alcoholism. If you're sitting in this room and you think that meeting attendance is doing AA, you're only half right. Because certainly the fellowship, it's important to show up at meetings. But if you're not working the steps with a sponsor, you don't have an AA program. And if you don't have an AA program, when you go back out, please don't say that AA didn't work or badmouth us, because we don't deserve it. I was told that back when, and I wasn't happy with that information because I was running around and I was like Mr. Meeting Maker making it. But the fact of the matter was I had a case of alcoholism. And alcoholism is not conquered by meeting attendance. There's a solution for alcoholism, and it has to do with the 12 steps, and it has to do with a way of life, and it has to do with the practice of spiritual principles, and it has to do with a lot of work. And I know we hate work, but I hated dying of alcoholism more. So I got busy with some of this stuff. We moved through the chapter to wives in the last month or so, and now we're moving into the family afterward. A little bit from my personal experience, my family afterward, the family that I married, and I had a daughter. That family was long gone by the time I showed up at Alcoholics Anonymous. That family had been long gone for about 8 years at that point in time, because my alcoholism was very, very progressive. Over any period of time, I was getting much worse. I was becoming violent. I had problems with responsibility. I had the emotional issues that happen with alcoholism, and I was no fun to be with. So, you know, when I looked at the chapter to wives and I looked at the family afterward, you know, I thought maybe these aren't really pertinent to me because I don't have a wife anymore. And my and the family afterward, the family after being with me. But, you know, what this chapter really is about is back in the 30s, more people stayed married than they do in the last 30 or 40 years. You know, we're a lot more likely to cut and run today than they were in the 30s. So they assumed that even the low-bottom alcoholics are still going to have a wife. Even the low-bottom alcoholics are still going to have a family. And they wanted to give those people information that would be conducive to a recovery. And I'll tell you what, there was somebody, one of my teachers started a recovery center and he worked in treatment his whole life, and the guy was absolutely phenomenal. He used to say something that I took exception to in the beginning, and this is what he would say: no codependency, no addiction. So what he was saying was he ran family programs for the people that were in his treatment center, and he was convinced after years and years and years of being in the field that how the family system operates is going to be very integral to the success of anyone in that family trying to recover from alcoholism or addiction. And I understand that. I've seen an example of this in my own family, basically recently, of someone who instead of making the decisions that would place the individual at meetings with a sponsor working a program, I've seen them basically buy into, you know, whatever that individual is saying about how they don't feel like going tonight or they need to go to the prom or they need to go over here or I'm busy with this stuff, and the family is like, okay, they're like buying into it, and the family is drinking and, you know, on all kinds of prescription pain pills while this individual is living there, you know, under 18 living there trying to get sober. It's not a conducive environment for recovery. So in this chapter to the family afterward, they're kind of warning you of, you know, what you're going to experience with the alcoholic in your family, and they're also trying to give you the tools that are going to be important for you if you, you know, want to help with the recovery of the individual who's in the family. So I'm going to start reading, and this is about five paragraphs down in the family afterward. Now and then, the family will be plagued by specters from the past, for the drinking career of almost every alcoholic has been marked by escapades, funny, humiliating, shameful, or tragic. The first impulse will be to bury those skeletons in a dark closet and padlock the door. The family may be obsessed with the idea that future happiness can be based only upon forgetfulness of the past. Such a view is quite self-centered and in direct conflict with the new way of life. Why is it self-centered? To just let bygones be bygones. Let's just not talk about this anymore. You know, let's just move on. Why would that be self-centered, and why would that be in conflict with a new way of life? Well, you learn as you go through the 12 steps. You're learning that self-evaluation is an incredibly important tool in your life. And to identify the people and the institutions that you have harmed and become willing to make amends to those people and those institutions, and then to actually go out and make amends to those people and those institutions, to pay the money back, all that is going to be directly related to whether you're going to survive alcoholism or not. And we've learned that in the 12 steps. So it's in direct conflict with our new way of life just to forget all this stuff and brush it under the rug. It's also very self-centered, you know. There's a great line in here. It says, we're like the farmer who comes up out of the cyclone cellar after a tornado hit. You know, don't see nothing the matter here, Ma. Isn't it great the wind stopped blowing? You know, I mean, we are tornadoes that roar through the lives of the people that care about us. It is unconscionable, some of the things that we do to our family, to our parents, to our wives and husbands. And to just blow that off and want to move on, that's incredibly selfish. We need to take responsibility for that stuff. We need to do what we can to set that right, set right those wrongs. And that's what we learn in the 12 steps. So that's why it's saying this. Henry Ford once made a wise remark to the effect that experience is the thing of supreme value in life. That is true only if one is willing to turn the past to good account. We grow by our willingness to face and rectify errors and convert them into assets. The alcoholic's past thus becomes the principal asset of the family, and frequently it is the only one. So why is our past, why does our past become so valuable? One of the reasons is an outgrowth of the results of the 12 steps are going to be, we are going to be fitted to be really, really useful to other alcoholics and other addicts. We're going to be the people that they will listen to when they won't listen to the $200 psychiatrist that they're paying for. They won't listen to the school counselors. They won't listen to the family. They won't listen to the neighbors. They won't listen to the cops. They won't listen to the judges. But they will listen to someone who they are convinced knows what they're talking about, has the same experience as they do. And so that's one of the reasons why our past is going to be very valuable. I also want to talk about experience and the difference between experience and opinion. I noticed that there's some people in here that, you know, probably in their first year. And I found this incredibly valuable when I learned this. When I came into AA, I thought, you know, people sharing this and people sharing that, I thought it was all AA. I thought, you know, oh, you know, so-and-so said, don't get in a relationship for the first year. You know, that's AA. Or I did not understand what was Alcoholics Anonymous and what wasn't until I started digging into this book. But another thing is, I heard a lot of opinions being shared in discussion meetings, and I couldn't tell the difference between an opinion and what's an opinion, what's AA. It all sounded like AA to me. Well, I'm going to try this story. Our buddy Charlie does this story, and I've never done it before. I'm going to give it a shot. This guy's driving through Texas, and he's driving down the road. He's got to get some gas for his truck, so he pulls off into this gas station. He's way the hell out in nowhere land, and as the guy's filling his gas tank, he looks over, and there's a sign, and it says, "Talking Dog for Sale." The guy goes, "Talking dog for sale?" So he asks the guy pumping the gas, he goes, "You got a talking dog for sale?" The guy goes, "Yeah, he's around back, you know, go take a look." So the guy goes around back, and he sees this dog, you know, tied up by the doghouse, and he goes, "Are you a talking dog?" And the dog says, "Absolutely I am." And he goes, "Wow, that's amazing. How did that happen?" He goes, "Well, I was a canine for a couple of years, and I started to pick up the nuances of the language, and I was able to infiltrate, you know, certain drug arrests and things that the police weren't able to do. So, you know, I kind of rose through the ranks a little bit, and I ended up working for the United Nations. And, you know, they would send me into different trouble spots around the globe, and, you know, I would gather intel, you know, for the CIA and the FBI, and, you know, But let me tell you this, that's not even the most amazing thing. Some of my pups, they've done so well in their careers that they're stationed all around the world at embassies, and they do incredibly interesting and valuable intelligence work for America at these embassies." And the guy goes, "Wow, that's pretty damn incredible. Thank you for sharing this with me." He goes back around to the front of the gas station, and he goes to the guy, he goes, "How much you want for a dog like that?" And the guy goes, I don't know, $40. The guy goes, $40 for a dog like that? And the guy goes, oh, none of that shit he told you was true. Right? Now, the point of this story is, the story is only valuable to us if it comes from our own experience. If it's our experience, it's got value. You know, if it's a line of crap, it really doesn't. So, anyway, how did I do on that?
You did better than Charlie.
I did better. No, I did not. This painful past may be of infinite value to other families still struggling with their problem. Absolutely. We think each family which has been relieved owes something to those which have not. And when the occasion requires, each member of it who has found God should be only too willing to bring former mistakes, no matter how grievous, out of their hiding places. Showing others who suffer how we were given victory is the very thing which makes life seem so worthwhile to us now. Cling to the thought that, in God's hands, the dark past is the greatest possession you have. The key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death and misery for them. One of the things that is almost organic, you go through the 12 steps. You address your amends. You start living reactively in step 10 with practicing these principles on all your affairs. You develop a discipline of prayer and meditation in step 11. Organically, you move then into step 12, which is to carry the message to other alcoholics. It's organic. You have had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. The next thing you want to do is carry this message to other alcoholics, to help other alcoholics. This has been my experience. I have spent a lot of the last 30 years trying to find ways to be helpful to the people who are still caught up in alcoholism. I tried very, very hard to develop a vocabulary to be able to communicate with people who are suffering from untreated alcoholism, to explain to them what untreated alcoholism is, to tell them exactly how it showed up in my life, to talk about the recovery program, how I experienced the steps, and to try to explain it in such a way that they might buy into the fact that it would be something that they would want to do. I've spent a lot of time doing this, and it's not like penance. It's not like I've decided I have to do this, to pay back. It's more of an organic thing, and it's come out of the service and the compassionate ethic that developed as a byproduct of the awakened spirit after going through these steps. And families back in the day when this book was written, the families would be at the meetings, the families would be taking the 12 steps along with the alcoholics. There was a lot of family recovery. Dr. Bob, if you showed up at his house where they had the very first meetings and you didn't have your wife with you, he'd make you go home and get her. She needs to be a part of this Alcoholics Anonymous thing. She needs to be a part of these steps. Now, as an outgrowth, we've developed Al-Anon. Al-Anon has, and it's kind of separated. They're kind of in two different rooms now. But still, it's a family recovery. It's a family. There's got to be a family recovery. Most treatment centers, if they see that the family's dysfunctional and they're still using and nobody wants to buy into any kind of self-discovery or self-assessment as far as the family system is concerned, will not want to send someone who's just getting out of treatment back to that family, because it's not going to be a good place for them to be. You'd be much better off in a halfway house seven states away than you would be going back to your family if there's not an understanding of this recovery system that's needed. It is possible to dig up past misdeeds so they become a blight, a veritable plague. For example, we know of situations in which the alcoholic or his wife have had love affairs. Oh, no. In the first flush of spiritual experience, they forgive each other and draw closer together. The miracle of reconciliation was at hand. Then, under one provocation or another, the aggrieved one would unearth the old affair and angrily cast its ashes about. A few of us have had these growing pains, and they hurt a great deal. Husbands and wives have sometimes been obliged to separate for a time until a new perspective, new victory over hurt pride, could be re-won. In most cases, the alcoholic survived this ordeal without relapse, but not always. So our rule is that unless some good and useful purpose is to be served, past occurrences are not discussed. You know, I knew some people back in the day who put a 7-day limit on it, like, you know, in their marriage. Okay, you got 7 days, we can bring this crap up. If it's older than 7 days, do not bring it up, you know, in the middle of a fight or something. You can't bring up 1972 anymore, you know. It's just, that's the deal we got. So I know people that have done that. One of the things that I had to learn, how to have discussions or how to fight right, you know, with the wife. And certain things, you know, need to be brought to the table. Okay, we're going to discuss this. Sometimes we're not going to discuss it, you know, anything but, you know, emotional terms. But there's a lot of lines I don't cross anymore that I used to cross. And bringing up old crap is one of them. You know what I mean? We families of Alcoholics Anonymous have few secrets. Everyone knows all about everyone else. This is a condition which, in ordinary life, would produce untold grief. There would be scandalous gossip, laughter at the expense of other people, and a tendency to take advantage of intimate information. Among us, these are rare occurrences. This is stuff that, you know, we're really a lot better today at than we were in the past. We do talk about each other a great deal, but almost invariably temper such talk by a spirit of love and tolerance. We discuss another's shortcomings in the hope that some new idea of helpfulness may come out of the conversation. The cynic might say we are good because we have to be. Another rule we observe carefully is that we do not relate intimate experiences of another person unless we are sure he would approve. We find it better, when possible, to stick to our own stories. A man may criticize or laugh at himself, and it will affect others favorably, but criticism or ridicule of him coming from another often produces the contrary effect. Members of a family should watch such matters carefully, for one careless, inconsiderate remark has been known to raise the very devil. We alcoholics are sensitive people. It takes some of us a long time to outgrow this serious handicap. You know, when I first read that alcoholics were sensitive, you know, that's earlier in the book. I understand today that's not a compliment. You know what I mean? When they say that we're sensitive, that's not a compliment. One of the things that I believe is common with alcoholics is we are keenly aware of injustice, especially when it concerns us. I mean, we can see somebody shortchanging us. We can see somebody taking advantage of us. We can see disrespect. We can see this stuff with laser vision. And I think it has a lot to do with the skill sets that we had to develop out there drinking and using. For us to have stayed alive doing the crazy things that we were doing, we had to develop some survival instincts. And I think that sensitivity is one of them. But in a recovered life, we have got to learn to not be so sensitive. It's gonna drive us crazy if we hold on to this sensitivity. Like, are you looking at me?
I am.
What are you looking at me for? You know, I mean, it just doesn't work in a recovered life. So the family afterward. One of the things we really have to do, and I'm going to be honest with you, the last place I practiced the principles of recovery was in my family. It took a long, long time for me really to practice the principles of recovery in my family, but I did do it. And I went from being the guy that none of them wanted to hang out with, none of them trusted, they were always waiting for the other shoe to drop. You know, I was pathetic, but they were stuck with me. I went from that guy to being the guy that you would call when you were in trouble. You know, if there's something you didn't understand, if your car wasn't working, if you needed this medical attention, if there was something wrong with the house, whatever, I became the guy who they actually did trust to come to when they needed help. And I also became the guy who would go there and help them. You know, I wouldn't come up with some excuse why I couldn't show up. To this day, my brother calls me up. His computer doesn't work, and I go over there and I take the mouse and I click on the start button, and up it comes. You look at me in my first year. What are you? Some kind of idiot? You can't start your own computer? Why don't you take lessons? No, I just go over there and I show him. Sometimes one more time, how to do this. What the hell? You know, I'm being a brother. What else have I got going on except being a brother? So it's like a change in perspective. I came in here with a broken perception about what the world was like, what was going on, how I was being treated, how I need to treat other people. It was all wrong and it was all broken. And getting to the other side of the steps, it's... You know, the family afterward, you know, I'm the one thing I feel bad about the family afterward is I've lost so many of them. You know, so many of them are gone. My mother and father have both passed, and a lot of uncles and aunts, and I have a very, very small nuclear family left. But I care for them very much, and you know, I really would like to help when I can. I'm not as selfish with my time as I used to be. You know, I've had a really good time with Dave doing this. Dave and I work really well together, and it's always a lot of fun. I expect that someday we're going to be back here, and we'll get maybe another chapter and a half done sometime. And one day we're going to actually finish the original manuscript, and that will be. That will be great indeed, but I'll turn it over to you, Dave.
Hi, everyone. My name is David Palmer. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic.
Hey.
Where are we?
Most alcoholics are
most alcoholics.
Enthusiasts.
Enthusiasts. Most alcoholics are enthusiasts. They run to extremes. At the beginning of recovery, a man will take, as a rule, one of two directions. He may either plunge into a frantic attempt to get on his feet in business, or he may be so enthralled by his new life that he talks or thinks of little else. In either case, certain family problems will arise. With these, we have experience galore. You know, it's very interesting that if you look back on the early days when Bill and Dr. Bob were working with others, they had a lot of these experiences where there was a lot of people who kind of said, okay, this is great, and I'm going to go out and get my life together again. Thank you very much. And off they'd go. And inevitably, they wouldn't stay sober. But then there was also people who took the other extreme. One was Clarence Snyder. If you go look up Clarence Snyder, he was from Cleveland. Once you set fire to Clarence, he never went out. I mean, literally, they wrote a story about Clarence. Well, actually, they wrote four stories about Clarence and the Cleveland Plains Dealer. They wrote a story once a week for a month. There was four articles on how Alcoholics Anonymous was saving people, curing people of alcoholism. Actually, this is how they called it. How did Clarence get the word of Alcoholics Anonymous, and why was it happening in Cleveland? Well, Clarence had started with the Oxford Group. He had come down to meet Dr. Bob, in Akron. And in the early days, they would, what was the name of the woman's house they would meet at? Not the Cyberland Estate.
T. Henry and Clarice Williams.
Yeah, T. Henry and Clarice Williams. They used to meet at her house and his house, and you know, over the first, I want to say about the first year that Clarence was coming down, he was driving out with six or seven alcoholics on a, you know, on a night, you know, sometimes two cars, sometimes three cars, and they filled up the room. Even though it was a kind of a mansion, they were overflowing at this point. And something happened. I think maybe a drunk threw up in one of Clarice's plants or something. But she suggested they might want to consider other accommodations. And Clarice says, "You know what? I think I'm going to start meetings in Cleveland because that's where they were from. It's not so far from Akron." So Clarence starts these meetings in Cleveland. And the way that it worked in Cleveland was this: they'd go to a hospital, all six, seven, eight, or ten of them. And they'd roll up on you, you'd be in bed, and you'd be coming out of a stupor. You'd be waking up a little. You remember when you used to wake up, and it tasted like somebody jammed a dead cat down your throat? And, like, that was the way the morning started, right? And, like, Chris would say, you come out of bed going, "Those bastards!" You know, and you wake up to Clarence. And he's ready to anoint your forehead with holy water. This guy's on fire, right? But what ends up happening is they write this article, this series of four articles in the Cleveland Plains Dealer. You can find them online. It's all out there, talking about how well these guys are doing. And what ended up happening was they started getting phone calls morning, noon, and night. So they couldn't go 6, 8, or 10 to a hospital. They had to start splitting people up. You two go to the Blessed Mother of Indifference, you know, and you two go over to the charity hospital and go find Bob or go find Sally and talk to them about the program, right? And some people say this is where sponsorship came from, right? Because they couldn't send everybody to the hospital. And Pirates was just on fire for years. You know, he's at one point, Alcoholics Anonymous, the general public thought it was started in Cleveland because of these articles and because of how active Clarence was. It's all he did. Now, I've had experience with kind of both ends of these spectrums. You know, when I came in 1985, you know, I was unemployable. I was unemployed, marijuana and cocaine slinger. You know, I didn't have any skill sets. I was a high school dropout. They gave me aptitude tests in the rehab, and I didn't pass anything. I was good for nothing. I was like, they go, "You should be weighing powders." I said, "I know." You know, and they said, "But you can't do that anymore." I said, "I know." So I got a job, right? Because you got to have a job. They get really sketchy if you don't have a job. So I got a job, and my first job out of rehab was working with a painter. Now, this man had so much faith in me that he let me paint closets, right? I couldn't paint the hallways, right? I couldn't do anything but paint closets. So I went from a $5,000 a week, you know, drug dealing deal to a $5 an hour. It wasn't $5 an hour, but it was something like that. You know, closet painter. And but I threw myself into service in Alcoholics Anonymous. I threw myself into a lot of stuff. And the funny thing was, this painter got a resentment against the woman's house we were working at, and I became unemployed. It was one of the few times in my life where a resentment caused my unemployment, and I didn't do it, right? But I found myself at one point in an unhealthy engagement with service work. Anybody here ever become the GSR, cookie boy, coffee guy, area guy, you know, bookers, chair leader, chair starter, meeting, well, website, whatever? Anybody ever do that? Anybody throw it? My kid, everybody did, right? At some point, if you haven't done it, you'll probably do it. And you'll regret it. I remember going to these meetings, and people would be droning on. I'd be going, "Oh, shut up." You know, "Well, we can save 11 cents a year if we don't buy those cookies." You know, and I'm like, "Oh, for the love of God, why?" And what ends up happening is when I don't have a balance in my life, right, I become useless to pretty much everybody, right? Unity and service and recovery, right? The three legacies inventory, right? That idea that I need to be whole and complete with my fellow man, with God, and with my recovery. Right, and when I talk about my fellow man, I'm talking about the people I work with. I talk about the people that I see on a daily basis. I talk about the family. Right, where am I in that triangle? If I'm only speaking at meetings and going to work, I don't have the balance. That's not service, right? I've done that. If I'm only doing service and not speaking at meetings or doing inventory, that's not healthy either, right? If I'm only going to work and making a ton of money, that's definitely not healthy for this boy, right? It does not last long. Where is the balance in my life? You know, I slowed down on my meetings and eventually stopped. After I moved to Westfield in 91, and I would stop going probably in 95 at about the 10-year anniversary. I'd go once every blue moon. And in 95, my business took off because I was devoting a lot of time to it. And I would say to my wife, we had a great year. We're not going to have a great year next year. You've got to understand the business I'm in. We're not going to have a great year the next year. I said, I'm very grateful to have had the year that we had. It's more than I've ever hoped for. Right? And I was grateful in 95. 96, I made twice as much money. And I said, I'm very grateful. 97, I made twice as much money. I said, I'm very grateful. 98, I made twice as much money. I said, I'm very grateful. In 99, I made twice as much money. I said, I'm very grateful. In 2000, I made twice as much money. And I said, I'm pretty fucking good. I am pretty fucking good. And spirituality went out the window. You see, when I focus on the things that I think are important, when I make money, my God, I'm in dire problems. But in the real world, I look okay. Right? I wear a nice suit. I got a nice car. The family looks happy because they get whatever they want. Right? This whole idea that I'm useless when I show up to the family doesn't occur to me, the guy who rolled in here, you know, in the back of a serious drug and alcohol problem and hoping he doesn't go to prison for 25 years. I forget that. Alcoholism is really good about reminding me about how wonderful I am, about just how absolutely wonderful I am. And this whole idea that I can bring something to the table, this whole idea that I can bring something to the table was foreign to me until I came back in 2004, you see, because I didn't even know what the table looked like or where it was. I just was driven by all these fears. I'd never have enough money. I'd never be anything, you know. I'd never be this. I'd never be that. I was driven by 100 forms of fear sober. Anybody here ever worry about their future? Anybody here? No? Everyone's shaking their head now. Anybody here ever lay awake at night plotting somebody else's demise? Right? A few hands go up.
A lot of hands.
Right? Worse, I mean, I don't know about you, but I've been so involved in my future, and none of it has ever happened. None of it. Nothing I've ever planned has ever happened. And the things that I try to execute on by physically taking action, they didn't happen either. Something else would happen. Something inevitably that would be better. Pain, right? Pain is one of the greatest gifts that we can give each other. Where does pain come from? Truth. Because the alcoholic doesn't want truth. Right? He wants some version of a delusion that looks like his own. Now, in 2004, when the ex-wife wanted to become an ex-wife, and I said, what can I do? And she says, try Alcoholics Anonymous again. And I show up at Alcoholics Anonymous again. It didn't fix the problem between her and I. Right? You think about family. Many of us have had problems with our families, but many of us remember a time, or believed in a time, or wished for a time, or currently have a time where we trusted our families wholeheartedly. Where our mother, our father, our sister, our brother, our son, our daughter is somebody that we know. It's a known unit. They might have a bad day. We might not talk for months, but they're family. And there's that connection. We don't have to earn that. In fact, sometimes we may want to be rid of that person. But we can't do that either, right? But friends are a different story. Marriages are a different story, right? That was one of the great things about Alcoholics Anonymous. I wandered in here, and you guys are like, welcome home, brother. I'm like, who the hell are you? Right? They go, there's coffee and cookies in the kitchen. I'm like, okay. I had come home finally. I had come home to a place where there was a family-like atmosphere. Some meetings, it was like the Manson family. Other meetings, it was like the Partridge family. Right? But whatever it was, it was. And it was okay. Right? In the real world, I've had a few friends in my life where I've met somebody in school when I was younger or later on, and you start talking to them and you go, I really connect with this person. You know, this is my new best friend, right? We're having a great time. This person's fun, right? And we connect on so many levels. Friends don't have to, once somebody becomes a friend, they don't have to earn something, right? If we go out to dinner, I'm not keeping track of who paid last time. I'm not keeping track of any of that stuff because I just want to be with you. Now, ultimately, we both know when we're supposed to pay or split or whatever the case might be. It doesn't matter, but nobody keeps track. And there's a reason that we don't keep track. Because as soon as I start keeping track, I'm starting to treat you like a business associate. Right? And where is the faith and trust there? Now, I rolled through the door in 2004... Right? And this woman, rightly so, is unhappy with me. Right? I had cheated on her. Or at least she believed I had. I hadn't told her the truth yet. I have broken faith. Right? I have broken a perceived or real, I have broken a contract that we had before God and my fellow man. I had stated to to love and honor until death do us part. Apparently that was good for 13 years. So this whole idea that I can come back home and it'd be all okay overnight is not what happens in my life. What happens is I show back up with that same alcohol thinking, just like Chris said. I come up out of the storm cellar and the wind stopped blowing, everything should be fine now, but it's not. Right? I've got to earn that trust back. I've got to work towards showing her what God has done for me that I could not do for myself. You see, because left to my own devices, just because I got caught, ain't going to fix my behavior, because I am prey to misery and depression. Right? I am the guy who lacks power, choice, and control. I am the guy who takes an honest first step after 26 years in this program and says, my life is unmanageable because I'm in charge. Took me 26 years to get there. Right? 26 years before I really realized that my life is unmanageable. Not my drinking, not my thinking, not anything. Everything is unmanageable because I'm trying to run the show. And I show up back in that house in 2004 and think I'm going to fix that overnight. The kids are going to love me overnight. Right? It's the same thing here in Alcoholics Anonymous. We all come in and we're willing to give each other hugs and everything else, and we're cool. We're having a great time. But if you want to get close to somebody, it requires writing inventory in a fifth step. Right? Inventory is the most freeing thing. Chris was talking about the dark past that we have. The skeletons that we should lock up in the closet that we want. Oh my God. When a sponsee calls me now and goes, she left. And I go, that's terrific. I got fired. Wonderful. Because now we can find out where you're broken with God, because you're all upset. Embrace these as the great things. In 1985, when I was laying on the gurney in a psychiatric hospital trying to chew through my wrist, covered in my own urine, and looking like the Unabomber on crack, I would have told you that was a bad day. And today, I think it's the most elegant spiritual awakening I have ever had. That moment of that nadir where I thought everything was over was the beginning of the most graceful part of my life. It was the turning point. And I did not want it. With all my heart, I didn't want to be there. I made a decision to make amends to my wife in 2004. I did an inventory, and I approached her. She didn't want to hear it. Okay? When we were getting divorced, 10 years later, because it took 10 years for us to get divorced, I approached her again after doing another inventory. Now, this inventory, right, because of work with Chris, I actually read the part in the big book about the inventory. It said, the person or persons who is to hear our inventory. I gave my inventory to, I think, 5 people. I think 3 men and 2 women. And I heard a different insight onto how I harmed others than I heard. Each one of them gave me a different insight into how I harmed others. I was fully prepared to make another set of amends to my wife. And she did not want to hear it. Right? But the funny thing about that amends was, I asked if she wanted to hear it. She said yes. I said, can we meet at 10 o'clock, at the house? She said yes. At 8:10, I woke up that morning and go, shit, I haven't written the amends cards yet, right? I'm not a bad alcoholic, right? I just hadn't gotten around to it. So I assiduously wrote my amends card, and at 9:45, I put the pen down, and tears were streaming down my face. Because for the very first time in my life, I knew what I had done to this woman, right? How onerous my presence had been in her life. And I was ready to make this right. At 10 minutes to 10, I got a text from her. She goes, I don't want to do it today. Let's do it some other time. And I thought to myself, okay, God wants me to go through this experience of becoming totally willing to make amends. Right? She's never wanted to meet and hear my amends again. She has her own reasons. It's okay. She's totally willing to try to get her free of me. Right? So this idea, right, of this connection that I have with family, this connection I have with a marriage, that sacred bond that we make when we get married, right? This is a commitment. It's a sacred commitment, right? This friendship that we have and the level of the friendship. And then when we hear that fifth step, right? Bill was talking about that, you know, we're families and we know all about each other, and you know, it doesn't get out, and you know, we're here in you know, love and tolerance, and these are the things that I lacked when I was out there drinking, right? Because I don't know about you, but in the end, it was a dark place. I didn't have a lot of people going, "Hey, Dave, what you doing tonight?" Right? They're like, "Yeah, busy," right? Because the way I drank was frightening, right? And the people I hung out with wanted to do drug deals, so everything was transactional. I was dying of a void of self. I was dying of a void of God. And I was dying of a void of you. It was simply the mechanical way of going through this world. Remove the alcohol from my life, and that void remains. Remove the alcohol from my life, and that broken individual is there in all my raw horror, right? This chapter talks all about how to be available to the family afterward, right? And the greatest gift that I can give anybody who I work with or anybody in this room tonight is just be honest with love. Right, I've become willing to tell every single family member anything at the drop of a hat if they want to know, right? And if I get it from prayer and meditation, right? I've made my amends to every family member except my ex-wife, who doesn't want to hear it. And you know, I've sought to bear the truth because it's a strange place. Some of you know this place and some of you don't yet. When you haven't told a lie and you've uncovered, discovered, and presented all the harms that you've done, you walk a free person in this world. You walk a free person. So that means when someone calls up and goes, "I gotta talk to you," you don't go, "What did I do?" You go, "Yeah, I'll be right over." Right? I stop screening calls in a recovered state. Right? I no longer worry about what's going to happen. When I show up for the family, I show up whole and complete and in the best state that I've ever been. Because every single hidden lie has been told. Every single thing. Not to everybody, right? But to the people who are supposed to hear it. Right? The people who I can best talk to. And that's the gift, right? Is that in that state I become ready. I have my youngest daughter right now, and I have the most amazing relationship that we've ever had. As does my wife, my new wife, with her. She lives in the house. She takes care of the house. We can't wait to see each other every week. It's never been like that before. And I didn't know that it would ever be like that. I could never have set my sights high enough. Right? I don't set my sights low anymore. Right? I don't look for the minimum. Everyone gets a pass. I learned that from Chris. Everyone gets a pass. They get more than one pass, right? Maybe not for them, but for me, because I can't live not handing out the passes. When I first told Chris about a situation I had where someone had treated me incorrectly, he says, "Well, why don't you give him a pass?" And I was literally dumbfounded because I went back over my life, and it, like one of those like 3-second things where your entire life throws to your head and go, "Shit, I've never given anyone a pass. Ever. No one's ever gotten a pass." I've carried with me from 72 commentary about what you did in 72. I would never let that go. Right? You don't get a pass. It takes a lot of energy to carry shit for 30 years. We pointed out the danger he runs if he rushes headlong at economic problem. The family will be affected also, pleasantly at first, as they feel their money troubles are to be solved. Then, not so pleasantly, as they find themselves neglected. Dad may be tired at night and preoccupied by day. He may take small interest in the children and may show irritation when reproved for his delinquencies. If not irritable, he may seem dull and boring, not gay and affectionate, as the family would like him to be. Mother may complain of inattention. They're all disappointed and soon let him feel it. So, what this happens to me, right? I don't have time for the family. I don't have time for the kids. For a moment, if I put myself in their shoes, which I would do after going through inventory in these rooms, right? I suddenly realize that the man that I'm supposed to care tremendously about, my father, is coming into my life, being irritated, and going to focus on something else, on the computer. You know? seems like his priorities aren't with me. They're somewhere else. My dad never came home, right? Because my dad was off doing stuff, right? My mother had to work all the time. That doesn't make it right for me to act that same way. She didn't do it because she wanted to. She did it because she had no choice in the 60s to be a single mother. When I start to put myself in other people's shoes and I start to see my behaviors, I immediately want to back off because I don't like what I see. That's not the truth anymore, right? Although I still have those moments today where I go, shit, you were an asshole, right? You just did an asshole thing. You need to go fix that. The funny thing is, I see it more often and far quicker today than I ever have. They're all disappointed and soon let him feel it, beginning with such complaints, a barrier arises. He is straining every nerve to make up for lost time. He is striving to recover fortune and reputation and thinks he's doing very well. And every penny I ever make... anybody here ever see Breaking Bad? Mm-hmm. Okay, so if you didn't see like the last episode or the last season, cover yours right now. In the end, she says, you did it for... and he interrupts her and goes, I did it for me. Sorry. I'm sorry. But that was me. I was making money, and I was happy the family was enjoying it, but it was for me. You see, because I had a hole in me where I didn't feel whole and complete, and if I just had a little more money, it would be okay. It was never about them. Until I realized that it needed to be about them. The funny thing was, that actually occurred just as soon as I almost went bankrupt. And I was on my knees in 2005 and said to God, I said, well, if you want everything, it's all yours. Right? And then it changed. Right? But once again, I was brought to the place of the maximum pain. Every time a sponsee calls you and goes, I can't believe what just happened, and go, good, let me get some soda and popcorn. I want to sit down and hear this. Right? Because it's the most gracious moment in time. You'll be able to help somebody make a change in their life. Because it's got to be a disbelief in God, right? If I'm worried about what happened, that means I don't believe it's going to be okay. I have not turned my will and my life under the care of God in that case. Of course, I'm human. I'm going to be upset. Mother and children don't think so. Having been wantonly neglected and misused in the past, they think father owes them more than they are getting. They want him to make a fuss over them. They expect him to give them the nice times they used to have before he drank and to show his contrition for what they suffered. But dad doesn't give freely of himself. Resentment grows. He becomes still less communicative. Sometimes he explodes over a trifle. The family is mystified. They criticize, pointing out how he is falling down on his spiritual program. This sort of thing must be stopped. Both father and the family are wrong. Though each side may have some justification, it is of little use to argue and only makes the impasse worse. The family must realize that dad, though marvelously improved, is still a sick man. I stopped drinking and doing drugs in 85. I weighed 136 pounds. And I only stopped because they locked me up into a rehab, in a psych hospital, actually. I weigh 216 right now. 80 pounds of spirituality. And I'm going to tell you the truth. I don't think that I really actually was able to put myself in my mother's shoes for all the shit that I put her through until about 5 years sober. I didn't actually begin to get a glimpse of that. And I only get the glimpse that I'm ready to see. It wouldn't be until many years later that I truly saw. It wouldn't be until my son started to have a few problems here and there that I went, holy shit. I would go out on like a Monday night at like 7 o'clock and come home on Wednesday morning. As a 15-year-old. No call, no nothing. My son comes home 45 minutes later. I'm like, there's something wrong. I'm terrified. I'm horrified. And I think back on the shit that I did. Oh, my God. I was a sick man when I came back in 1985, and I stayed sick for many years, even though I wanted to be better, because I was still aligned with the idea that I'd somehow make a better Dave. When I came back in 2004 and started doing this work, things actually changed. And I was able to see my shortcomings much faster, and I was able to see where I was harming others. But the truth of this paragraph is that when family members of mine have gotten sick and ended up in these rooms, I have had to be compassionate beyond... I had to be compassionate on God's time, and I had to be compassionate in God's way. Because I wanted to say things that I shouldn't say. I wanted to give direction, say what you should do, be in charge of your life now because look at what you did to your life. And the best response that I got from prayer and meditation was shut up. Just shut up and be there. Love and tolerance, right? That's what we're supposed to do. Because that family member was a sick person. Just as I've been a sick person at times. They should thank God he is sober and able to be of this world once more. Let them praise his progress. Let them remember that his drinking wrought all kinds of damage that they may take long to repair. If they sense these things, they will not take so seriously his periods of crankiness, depression, or apathy, which will disappear when there is tolerance, love, and spiritual understanding. All you, if you want to finish up.
The head of the house ought to remember that he is mainly to blame for what befell his home. He can scarcely square the account in his lifetime, but he must see the danger of overcompensating on financial success. Although financial recovery is on the way for many of us, we found we could not place money first. For us, material well-being always followed spiritual progress. It never preceded it. So, they're assuming the alcoholic is the head of the house. Let's just say for a minute he is. We are mainly to blame for all the problems that have happened there. We can scarcely square the account in our whole lifetime. But we must really try to do that. And there's a warning here about making the money. I can't tell you how many people I've seen jump into Alcoholics Anonymous and then get better at work. You know, work is going really well. Hey, I got a promotion. And all of a sudden, work is more important than meetings. And work is more important than working with a sponsor. And work is more important than the step work. I've seen people do that with exercise. I've seen them do it with any number of things. One of the things that we must maintain is a healthy balance as far as what we do. You know, we don't recover by what we think and by what we know. We recover by what we do. So we need to have enough time in the day for us to be able to do these things that will lead to our recovery. Right, Dave?
Time in the day. I'm busy.
You're busy. Dave's busy. You know, that's all I got.
I think that's it. So I think that's the end of the workshop, and we'll be back in a year or so.